So,
yes, do you need to, I don't know.
I'm totally on now. I feel like I need to give a slight, you're never supposed to apologise at the beginning of talks, but I just feel like I need to give a slight apology. If I was technologically minded and had put more time into this, this lends itself to quite a nice slideshow, and actually I managed to get 6 slides and only 3 of them work, so this is a bit of a red herring over here. Not much is going to happen, so maybe don't get your hopes up for the visuals on this talk. So I was asked to come and talk about something that inspires me, and also something that was distinctive and radical about Buddhism, and maybe particularly Buddhism in Sri Ratna. So what was inspiring me when I got the invite was this image, was an image. And I thought, well, I want to talk about the image that's inspiring me. And in a way, I figured that was fine, because the imagination's quite strongly emphasised. It's a distinctive feature of Sangharakshita's presentation of the Dharma. And it matters because what we imagine determines what we perceive. And perception itself is not, it's not a passive, receptive, a passive receptivity to sense data coming in. It's something that's soaked with emotion and what we imagine and what we story about life and how things are. So I'm going to begin with a couple of incidents. One was on the Wednesday, the 25th of January in 2006. I wasn't there, but I heard about it. But I was in Cambridge, so there's a big museum in Cambridge called the Fitzwilliam Museum. And on that day, a man slipped down the steps. They were the main steps at the front of the museum. And on the landing, at the bottom of the flight of steps were 3 very large Chinese antique vases that had been there for about 40 years. Mm-hmm. And he knocked into one, and I think that knocked into the others. So all 3 of them smashed to bits. And the staff, and they all got jumbled up together. And so the staff ended up sweeping them all up into a pile. And the general view of, you know, the local press and local population was like, there's no way you're going to be able to repair that. There's no way you're going to be able to do it. So that's one little incident. And then the other little incident is about 500 years earlier, when quite a powerful shogun in Japan called Ashikaga Yoshimasa, that's my best Japanese accent, had his favourite tea bowl. It was Chinese again, so it's a Chinese tea bowl in Japan. And it got broken one day. I don't know quite how it got broken, but it got broken. So there you go. 2 people, or rather an institution and a person, with broken things. Quite important to them, broken things. So we know that things break. Yeah, ordinary things break, and rare and precious things break, and sometimes our favourite things break. And bigger things can break as well. You know, houses can collapse sometimes, and trees get blown down, and or just simply shed their branches, which is what the one in front of Taraloka does quite a lot. And, you know, sometimes there's earthquakes, like in Cardiff. I don't think actually the earth cracked in Cardiff, but, you know, it can. And really big things like stars can go supernova. So we know that things can break and shatter. And we know that our bodies too can break. In fact, it was a source of confusion for me as a little girl, because I couldn't understand why adults so casually talked about someone breaking a leg, because to my mind it would be the same as breaking a cup, you know, when the handle would fall off. Took me ages to work out that the leg didn't actually fall off. But anyway, nonetheless, we can break our bones, our health can break, we can be beset by illness, old age, and ultimately death. There's a sort of breaking down. Our minds can break down. We can suffer from psychosis and madness and other sorts of mental illnesses. Our relationships can break down. Our marriage, our friendships, and then negotiations and agreements and trade deals, they can all break down. And our vision too can break down. Midlife crises, dark nights of the soul. So plenty of breaking is possible in this world. And we actually live, I mean, every culture's got a creation myth. And our creation myth is a scientific one. It's called the Big Bang, isn't it? So we have a creation myth that's about breaking. Yeah, this idea that 13.77 billion years ago, give or take 59 million years apparently, either way, there was some sort of enormous Big Bang that arose out of something that was, we can't even see because it's outside the space-time dimensions. Anyway, something went bang somehow. And this is the imagined starting point, as far as we're concerned, for our world, our universe. And we tend to think maybe that... to say that starting point is history, we're slightly understating it. It counts as pre-history, doesn't it? But we tend to think that history is in the past, and there was a point that this philosopher Tim Morton was making in a talk I was listening to, where he said, well, the thing is, history is still happening now. And he suggested that the Big Bang is still happening now. It's just this is what it looks like, and I quite like that. So there we go, we're part of the Big Bang. We're still part of this extraordinary breaking or shattering that's been going on for quite a long time. So I'm just putting a one-sided picture at the moment. It'd be fair enough for you to say that, well, not everything breaks, which it doesn't, but things form too. And the other side of breaking is this arising of what's new. New things, new possibilities, new conjunctions, new relationships. So we get life arising out of inorganic matter, organic matter. We get new beings, new moments, new ideas, new discoveries. So Buddhist practice is very much aware of both sides of this coin of impermanence. And these are the givens of the world that we live in. Yeah, this arising and this ceasing, this arising and falling away of all things. They're all impermanent. They all arise and they all fall away, or sometimes break, in dependence upon conditions. So what I was thinking though is it's quite easy think and talk about the spiritual life and spiritual practice as the opposite of breaking and what is broken. We tend to, or maybe this is just me, it's easy to imagine it as something to do with wholeness, completeness, perfection. Which then kind of gives us an image of a path which is somehow smooth and steady and integrating. And that we simply move from imperfection to perfection, from hatred to love, from ignorance to wisdom, from samsara to nirvana. And I just wanted to look a little bit more about, well, where's the breaking, or is there a place for breaking in Buddhism and in Buddhist practice? Because Buddhism is also very insistent that we turn towards our existential situation. That's a very important part of Buddhism. The four reminders, which are reflections that you can do that are, in a way, are motivations to practice, include looking at reflecting on impermanence and the imperfections of samsara. So this is what I wanted to explore. And part of the reason why I was thinking about this was just in terms of my practice of metta and my practice of friendship or sangha. So I got taught the Metta Bhava 27 years ago, and I can still remember the instruction was something like, you know, bring your awareness to the heart area. I had no idea what they're talking about, absolutely none. I didn't know where my heart was. But I did find it a very helpful practice, a five-stage practice, bringing love to all the different sorts of relationships in my life. And that love, the idea that there could be a love which was free of any sort of attachment, unconditional, radiant, boundless, and in a way open to all beings, so not withheld in any way. It sounded great, and over the years I feel like it's made a huge difference to me. I think both in terms of loving myself, but also in terms of others and also in terms of life. But I've also lived in a community for like umpteen years, and you know, pretty much every day I kind of notice all the nicks and the flaws and the breaks and the flinching and the withdrawals and the cracks and the annoyance and the polarizations and all those sorts of things that go on just in day-to-day interactions with people, and not just me. In a way, I'm seeing those as the breaks and the cracks. And what I notice is it's really easy to get into thinking that it's gone wrong, it's going wrong, and that this is bad, and if I was doing it right, it would all be sort of smooth and whole and, you know, happier looking in some sort of way. So it struck me that if you have that view, then immediately there's aversion to things going wrong. Yes, so there's going wrong, it's gone wrong, and then there's aversion and anxiety and fear that it's all a bit of a disaster. But if all these breaks are inevitable, then you might have a different attitude to them. If you see them as like, well, actually, it's sort of inherent to how things are, then you might be able to come into relationship with them. And as aversion is the opposite of metta, then if you can have a more positive or creative view of breaking, then you can hold that. That positive view in itself is metaphor, and you can hold that with metta. Otherwise, I think what happens is that you have large areas of maybe your experience in your life which simply are kind of wrong, or failures in practice that in a way fall outside of in a way what we think of as our practice, if that makes sense. So this is my attempt to just reimagine this whole area. And I've got two images. One came, there's quite a few people at the moment in the movement, they're getting trained in restorative process as opposed to retributive justice. So it kicks in when relationships are broken down, yeah, when things have gone wrong, there is breaking. And retributive justice is about sort of almost separating the broken parties and someone else coming in and deciding what's fair and how to make amends. But what doesn't happen is the communication. And the restorative process is about bringing those broken parties back together, back into relationship, and asking, what does it take to get back into relationship? And the woman who was teaching us the other month, she got two people up, and she accidentally chose people who were two people who were very good friends. But she said, imagine these two are good friends. we didn't need to because they were. And she got them to hold a piece of string between them. She said, this is a friendship. This is a friendship. And sometimes things get a bit fraught between people, and that string of friendship gets rather taut and tense. And sometimes things go wrong, and she got a pair of scissors out and cut string. So now you've got a broken friendship. But she was saying, well, what do you do when you've got a broken friendship? You don't say, oh, no, it's all gone wrong. It's like, well, you've got two ends of a thread. How do you tie that knot? So she tied the knot and said, so first of all, you have to discover how to tie the knot. And that really helps in all future knot-tying situations. The next point was the knot is sometimes the strongest part of that thread. And then the next point was, because you've tied a knot, the string's now shorter and those two people are closer together. So I really liked that image. I thought that kind of worked. And what she was doing was just reframing this whole area. But the other image I've got is back to these smashed vases. So the Fitzwilliam Museum, the poor old, I don't know what they're called, experts in restoration. Anyway, they spent 7 months gluing these vases back together again. And what they were trying to do was make them look as if they'd never broken. I think this is really interesting. So the ideal is to bring them back to a point where it's as if that never happened to them. And they did a very skilled job, so you couldn't necessarily see all the breaks, or maybe hardly any of them. But those vases can never be displayed in daylight because the glue will yellow if it's exposed to daylight. And then all those cracks will show. So you kind of got this artificial situation. So that's their solution. So what happened to the Shogun 500 years ago? Well, he sent his ceramic teapot back to China, which was where it was made. Said, you know, get the people who've made it to repair it. And they sent it back. They did a hideous job. They sent it back with sort of metal staples through it or something awful. It was absolutely terrible. It probably cost him a bomb. And it was a complete disaster. So he didn't want to give up on this favourite bowl of his. So what he did is he turned to his craftsman and said, can you come up with a better way of fixing this? Can you come up with something else? Yeah. And what they came up with was what's been called kintsugi, or gold joinery, which is what we've got this image of here. And what they do is they take a glue or a lacquer and they mix in gold powder. And they use that to very carefully and delicately and sensitively bring the cracks together and recreate the bowl or whatever it is, a ceramic. And this has become an art form in its own right. But the philosophy of it is not to hide the breaking. Yeah? The philosophy of it is that the breaks and the repair is part of the history of the object, not something to be hidden. So along with this, the idea of wabi-sabi, which you get this sort of appreciation of, well, sometimes it's translated as rustic. I won't go into wabi-sabi particularly, but it shares its philosophy with wabi-sabi of embracing the flawed and the imperfect. So it has this aesthetic value that marks where, you know, and appreciates where from usage. Yeah. It highlights cracks and repairs, and it underscores them as events in the life of an object rather than as the end of useful life of something. It's the opposite of disposable culture. Yeah? It's the opposite of this idea where broken is wrong, useless, outmoded, and worthless, and suitable only to be thrown out. Which is interesting because that's the sort of culture we live in, the disposable culture. And that will affect how we imagine all brokenness, yeah? Including that within us and between us. You know, look how we learn to disguise signs of aging and wear in ourselves. Yeah, with quite strong social sort of pressures to look young and whole in a certain sort of way. A lot of hiddenness of mental health issues. I mean, just think it's fairly... There's a very superficial sort of layer that goes on in our society, isn't there? Like, it's all right. And it's so not all right underneath the surface. So kintsugi, it just offers something to do with authenticity. Something that's not about conceit or a lie or a shiny plastic promise. It offers something that's about the aesthetics of existence, what it is to exist in this world. And it's also got an emotional or affective dimension to it, which is one of poignancy and empathy and a profound sensitivity to the nature of our existential situation. Yeah, perhaps even a touch of melancholy at times. So maybe this is actually how the heart can experience and respond to impermanence and loss. So again, the Japanese have a term for this, which they call it mono no aware. That's probably terribly badly pronounced. But that's their term for this poignancy and sensitivity and this aesthetic of the impermanent. And we have something a little bit... when I was looking this up, something a little bit similar in the Western tradition, although maybe a bit far back, goes far back to Virgil and the Aeneids. He uses the Latin word lacrimae there, and it's been translated in different ways, but a guy called Fagles translated lacrimae as, well, it might have been part of a slightly longer sentence, but anyway, he's saying the world is a world of tears and the burdens of mortality touch the heart, which I thought was rather lovely. And then Seamus Heaney came along and translated it as there are tears at the heart of things, which I think is even better, which is rather fantastic. It's a bit of a genius with Heaney. There are tears at the heart of things. So for me, there's something very immediately softening in the heart when I just read something like that. I just think, yeah. So there's this deep connection between change or impermanence, love, sensitivity, beauty, and empathy. Yeah, they can all hold together. And kintsugi is also related to the Japanese philosophy of mushin. Again, I don't know how you pronounce that. It literally means no mind, which perhaps doesn't help very much. But it has connotations of fully existing within the moment, of non-attachment, of equanimity amid changing conditions. So there's a little quote from someone called Christy Bartlett who's talking about this and kintsugi, and says, not only is there no attempt to hide the damage, but the repair is literally illuminated, a kind of physical expression of the spirit of mushin. The vicissitudes of existence over time, to which all humans are susceptible, could not be clearer than in the breaks, the knocks, and the shattering to which ceramic ware too is subject. So we see something like a broken bowl put back together again, and we recognise ourselves in that. And we recognise if it's put back together with care and gold, we recognise what we can do for ourselves in that as well. So in terms of practice, I think what this can do, this reimagining of what breaking and brokenness looks like and can be, we can bring that into our relationships, into community, into Sangha. And I think it can help reduce a sort of horrified anxiety and sense of things being irredeemable and irreparable. Yeah. And I think because in Tree Ratna we've got a strong emphasis on Sangha, I was thinking actually there's a stress on Sangha and a stress on a particular area will also yield the flaws in it. You know, it kind of, if you put more emphasis, you'll also notice where it doesn't quite work. So if we've got a strong emphasis on Sangha, we will also notice the way in which it doesn't live up to the ideals, the ways in which it is difficult. And I just think this idea of imagining it where you understand that the breaking and the repairing of it is fundamental to the very practice itself, then it gives you a different way in. And in a way, the metta practice itself, it has this, you know, the fourth stage is all about love directed to what's broken. So in a way, it has that stage there. So we learn it, we teach it to beginners. There's probably not many places you can go where you get taught how to, or even to consider bringing love to something that's very broken in that way. And I think of gold as the illumination that metta can bring. But I also think that the metta bhavana, it allows you, as you go deeper into the metta bhavana, it allows you to reconsider other breaks, and in a way they're the sort of... the conceptual breaks that we place upon our experience, the lines of separation that we draw between ourselves and other things, which in a way causes isolation and a certain amount of pain. So we create these breaks of self and other, and of liking and disliking, and of friend and enemy, and of human and animal, or living and non-living. Yeah, and we create a broken world in our minds. And again, I think the metta bhavana offers us a chance to bring gold into those breaks, and start to, in a way to we, you sort of when you. Create those breaks, it's like you, particularly in relation to the world, it's like you kind of kill the world in a certain sort of way. Yeah, you flatten it into something inanimate and dead. And what we're trying to do is bring kindness back into reanimate it and bring it alive, which means to be in relationship with it, which means to be a part of it and not separate and outside of it. So I think this gold allows our psyche and the world psyche to come into relationship, to use that particular way of speaking. And maybe going even further again, is underpinning all of that is this idea of emptiness or shunyata, which is that everything lacks a sort of inherent separate existence, which is a very radical dimension of Buddhism. Which means that, in a way, there are no separate things to come into relationship with. You could say there is relationship without the things. Gold, maybe, just gold. So it also struck me, thinking about this area, that... I just wonder if I've missed a bit... gone slightly out of order there for some reason. Oh, here we go. So I've just I'm going to have to just jump back because I just missed a little bit. Yeah, so just so jumping back to Kintsugi again, I'll just say this anyway. This reframing of imperfection, it's what, you know, probably what a lot of people bring to mind is Leonard Cohen's, you know, forget your perfect offering, there's a crack in everything, that's how the light gets in. He nailed the same concept, didn't he? And I think that's why people like that line. There's also this idea runs through into the Japanese tea ceremony. And I found this little quote by some famous tea master I've not heard of. I'm not going to try and pronounce the name. He said, "In the small tea room, it is desirable for every utensil to be less than adequate." Mm-hmm. I really like that. Perhaps it's desirable for us to be less than adequate in terms of practicing the Dharma. Otherwise, it can't sort of break us in the way that we need to break. But yeah, the bit that I remembered that I just thought I'm missing a bit was to do with when there aren't those flaws or breaking points. So I don't know if people watched any of the programmes that Grace and Perry did on TV, looking at identity, and he's making portraits of people with, one series with people with sort of having crises in their identity. So one of the people he wanted to do a portrait of was Chris Huhne, the disgraced MP who, I don't know if you remember, his wife took the rap for speeding when actually it was him driving the car, and then he foolishly dumped her for a girlfriend, and the angry wife told on him, and they both ended up going to prison. So it was a complete disaster. So Grayson met up with him like the day after he'd come out of prison. And he was kind of interesting looking at him because he seemed like a perfectly nice man, but there was a problem in that even after he'd been to prison, he seemed to have no sense of remorse, regret, sorrow, having learnt anything. He just seemed to be this kind of cheery guy, full of bonhomie, but like there was no underbelly to him almost. And Grayson was trying to ask him questions, and it's just like, it was like Teflon. It's just sliding off him. It's very weird. Grayson Perry's response was to his portrait of Chris Hume was in the form of a vase. It was a huge big vase. And then what he did was he took a hammer to it and smashed it. And then he got some people to put it back together with gold. So this gold joinery technique. And the point he was making was that he couldn't find any vulnerability in Chris Hume. He couldn't find any vulnerability there. And him smashing the vase and bringing the gold in was his attempt to kind of like bring a vision as a vulnerability through breaking and mending that didn't seem to be happening. So it was an interesting example of when actually it's not a good thing not to break. It's not that helpful in terms of really learning and really changing. Okay. So going back to Kintsugi and Buddhist practice, it struck me also that it offers a way of looking at our system of spiritual practice, which you're probably familiar with, the sort of system of spiritual practice. It's talked about quite a lot: integration, positive emotion, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and then we've got spiritual receptivity in the middle. But it struck me what this breaking, in a way, is what that term spiritual death relates to, and that actually, this way of thinking about it, that spiritual death is just absolutely inevitable. The way life is means that spiritual death will just happen because things break. And what it offers is that those breaking moments or times get held in with care and tenderness, which is to say mindfulness and metta. That's the gold and the craft in how you hold it. And when it gets put back together, it never gets put back together the same way. It never is or tries to pretend to be something the same as how it was. And that's the spiritual rebirth bit. So this might be true for you or me as individuals, and I also thought this is probably true for the Sangha as a whole. The Sangha's a like a beautiful vessel, maybe, that is, well, although it's beautiful, it's always inadequate. It's always inadequate to hold the Dharma. So it constantly breaks and reforms. And in a way, if you get something constantly breaking and reforming, what you end up with, or like in my mind, in one meditation, thinking about it, it became a sort of shimmering, fluid shape of light. Yeah, something that kind of glitters, that is in constant flux. And maybe that's a way of thinking about what the Sangha is. Yeah. So just to sort of sum up a little bit, I've just been saying all things break. Buddhism is a turning towards that. That it's important that we reimagine the significance of breaking. And that it's important that we reimagine that in a way that allows a sense of beauty and aesthetics, that allows a sense of poignancy and sensitivity in a way that speaks to the heart, and that allows for an equanimity, and that maybe that is what change and transformation looks like. And maybe this also is an image for all living beings, actually, not just us practicing, but this breaking and reconfiguring is creates a sort of shimmering vessel of relationships that is the world, relationships between all living beings. That is what this very fragile, exquisite blue-green planet is that we live on. And perhaps if we were better able to reimagine those shatterings, we wouldn't need to isolate ourselves so much from other living beings, to regard ourselves as separate from our environment, to deny or refuse our rubbish and refuse. Perhaps we'd take more care, and perhaps we'd live as if this was the only home that we have, and not as if we could throw it away or buy a new one. And perhaps we need to practice picking up the pieces. So I'll just finish with a quote from Ernest Hemingway in A Farewell to Arms. Says, the world breaks everyone, and afterwards many are strong at the broken places.